There's these two guys that good friends. The very beginning of their life, a child that always lived out into their elder age. And the two guys had always had the same identical discussion, same identical fight about God. The black man said, I know God has got to be black. There's just no other way around it. God is black. The white man's like, no, his friend's like, he's white, I know he's white. The white guy thinks he's white, the black guy thinks he's black. Well, it just so happens that at the end of their lives, they both happen to die at the same time, so they happen together. And they're coming up to the pearly gates, and they say, St. Peter, and they're like, St. Peter, help us with this. It's like, we've always wondered, what is, we've always had this debate our entire life. Is God black or is God white? And just so happened, God walked around the corner through the pearly gates, and he said, Dios amigos, I almost said, oh, no. I was like, Buenos Dios, I almost said, adios. Well, that was a good joke, okay. Broke my eyes.
Don't look at me.
One thing that I think I really want to get across at the very, very beginning before you reach out is how we believe that God is such a big God. He's such a huge, gigantic God. The God that we serve, the God that we run to, it's just amazing. I think that one of my favorite illustrations, and this wasn't necessarily talking about God, but I'm going to use it for God, because that's what it did for me. Do you remember the Man in Black movie, at the very end of the movie? For those of you who saw it, you'll probably be able to get a visual of it, but at the very end, you see the, you're on the street with the guy, and you move, Will Smith, and as you're moving back, you see the street from a distance, and you see the city, then you see the oceans and lakes and rivers, and you start moving farther and farther and farther back, and then all of a sudden the real is, from like a moon view. You go past the moon, the Saturn, all the different planets. You head out past the solar system. You head out past the universe and see all these other universes. And then you kind of fold into this circular vision as you're pulling out, and it ends up being a marble on the table of this creature, and you snap the marble. And I just was like, that is just, to me, one of the coolest illustrations I could have possibly visualized. That would explain how big my God is. I'm just this little teeny dot. It was 1 of 6 billion dots on that little teeny speck. Inside that multiple universes, it's onto a marble on the table. God. That's how I see it. And so when I run to God and ask God for help, I come to God. And I try to remind myself of that all the time. And I'm overwhelmed. You're overwhelming about cancer or CMV or anything like that, and you have AIDS on top of it. It just becomes overwhelming. And you think, oh my gosh, my problems are so massive. My problems are so big. I'm losing my voice to absorb everything else. My problems are so massive and my problems are so big I cannot bear them. And how on earth is God going to fix them? And I remember that picture of how massive and how big my God is. And then I'm able to remember. That's the God that I'm running to. That's what I'm talking to. That's how I'm asking for help. And that's who loves me so absolutely unconditionally. It's amazing to me that I'm the speck on that planet, on that marble on this table. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And it blows my mind. So that's the God I run to. Not just a big, massive, overwhelming God, but one that loves me absolutely unconditionally. Right now, I'm so out of my element. I'm like wanting to put my hand. I just came out of Worthy's workshop, and he made this thing I know. And I have never in my life had nail polish. I just got the most obnoxious colors I could find because it scared the crap out of me. And now I'm a gay man with AIDS. It looks like I have 10 bleeding fingers, so I'm really going to be scared. Where do you want to go ahead and start? You want to do the synopsis? Or?
Well, I just want to say, it's kind of funny preparing for this workshop because in some ways it was easy to prepare for, but yet in other ways it was not easy to prepare for because it's really just, it's our story. And, it's not a clinical workshop. It's not something on the latest medicines, and because there's so much out there, it's constantly changing. We're all on such different regimes. He and I couldn't be further from each other in what kind of medications that we take and how it affects our bodies and what what I've been through versus what he's been through, even though we've been positive for the same amount of time, our stories in that regard are not even close. So, and anybody in here that's positive, you know that. You know that, you know, you see your friends going through one side of hell that you've never experienced, and then you experience a completely different side of hell. And so this is more about just where we've been met by everything from people we know well enough to friends and family, to where we've been met by just people we have no clue, that we don't have no personal relationship with. And so in that, you know, it's kind of, we designed this workshop to be sort of an intermingling of the two, our story with being at the crossroads. And in the past 16 years, we've had 10 years, roughly, of crossroads. And so it's been kind of interesting for us. So I'd like to start out with, you know, and also too, we'd like to always keep it open for being dynamic. If you have questions or comments.
If you have things that have gone through in your life that are really applicable, interrupt.
So, yeah.
This isn't like a formal teaching session. We're just kind of going to share our life, things that have happened to us, and the practical things that have, that people have done for us that have really ministered to us. And how even us, and for those of you that might be HIV positive, have AIDS or friends that play, how they're still in a position to minister to also. And hopefully it'll give you something to walk out of this room with, so it's not just information or knowledge. Hopefully it can give you something that you can, that's tangible, that you can actually do when you walk out the door.
So I guess I was gonna, I kind of thought, you know, I'd go through some definitions. I looked up caregiver on the Merriam-Webster website, and came up with five definitions. First one was being an individual such as a physician, nurse, or social worker who assists in the identification, prevention, or treatment of an illness or disability. An individual such as a parent, foster parent, or head of a household who attends to the needs of a child or a dependent adult. Further definition, a person who helps in identifying or preventing or treating illness or disability. A person who is synonymous with a health professional or a health care provider, and then a person who is responsible for attending to the needs of a child or dependent adult. I guess that was two of my things. They were all combined. So I kind of thought that we'd show you where. I haven't done the focus on this, so we'll see how it works.
Our journey, I'll kind of give you a synopsis.
This is where our journey began.
Yeah.
This is David and I. This is a family portrait. Us and our baby. She looks like David.
Well, I look like her more now. It was 15 years. So.
This is probably 1991. And so this is you know, a couple years into our relationship, but things are still wonderful, and we just lost her just a month ago. So it was a sad day, but this was us. Life was good. Life was great. Nothing had
to be. Yeah, we were still really helpful then. We had no opportunity anything the entire time that we lived in Denver. And so I wasn't until we moved to Houston almost 11 years ago, when about a year after we moved there, that's when all that's really great. We were actually diagnosed 16 years ago, but the doctors, when we were diagnosed, had just come up with the same forecast, and Patrick's were 52, 53, and mine were like 120. So we were already both on AIDS, and as soon as we were diagnosed, so they had told us that we had had AIDS probably for at least 2 to 3, maybe 4 years, so it could be 18, it could be 20, we had no idea. For me, I think I know when I got it. I've appeared in my life when there's no way I couldn't have got it. So, but there was a period of time there when we were testing. I think a lot of you guys will probably remember that, when we were testing false negatives. And it's just so bizarre that both of us were probably testing false negatives for years. And then when we meet, before we actually settle down and have our tremendous amount of money that the Southern Exchange brings. 16 years ago, we found out both of us were positive at the same time. And it was almost kind of a blessing, not a weird disguise, because neither of us had the worry that one may be better than the other. We obviously had had it for years before we ever came together. So that was kind of a strange blessing in disguise. So when we moved to Houston about 11 years ago, a little over a year after that, I got my first cancer. And it was a lymphoma and necrosis combined, and it was something I talked about literally. So it spread all through my throat, cheeks, and metastasized. And there was just no way that the doctors thought I could live. And she had found it first. She had been licking my throat incessantly. Bless you. She had been licking my throat incessantly. And just, you know, when you pull the dog away, how they stretch their neck. I mean, she was just like determined. And she found the cancer before they did. The second time I had cancer, it was in the sinus cavity. Once again, we're not just incessant licking. And the licking stopped when the cancer was over. And so she was kind of like, I recall her nurse shock, because she kind of nursed me back to health a lot. She found the cancer a couple of times. And so living here was a huge thing. And I'm sure most of you have probably been through the health loss. So it's hard for me to still, for a month ago, I didn't get that wish. Anyways, we've been through cancer. We've been through my cancer four times.
We've been through cancer.
He's probably, and that's one thing that we really want to stress too, hopefully in this workshop, to understand how important it is to support the caregiver. I was a caregiver only once with him when he had enterovirus ailments, lungs and heart, and had distributed fluids all throughout his cardio and lung nerve. And so the 1200 cc's, which is bigger than his heart and lungs, pressing up against that. So he almost died. In fact, the first, I reported to the hospital with 12 doctors in my arms and just completely went stiff. It was the most horrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. I saw him teetering in the hallway and I came running behind him. I grabbed him and I just fall and we both fall back together and he's like this. His arms are all cupped, his head's cupped back, his eyes are wide open. His face is flushed and he can't hear anything there. It was just like a blank look. I thought he would die. And the next couple of weeks after that, it was just like we were in the hospital. When one of us goes in the hospital, our life, unfortunately, life can stop. And we can stop working and we're there and we just move into the hospital.
But we digress.
I'm saying too much. I was going to synopsis. I'm talking too much.
We just got off track and I didn't yank us back to.
He's actually able to be doing this, so this will be good.
No, this works. So anyway, this is how I'm going to choose. So anyway, 1989, this is about 1991, you get together, 89, find out, Motorola is 52, low hundreds for 100 something. So we know we're not doing great, only medication, AZT. So we actually took AZT for 7 years, because there's nothing else, and we didn't know you could become resistant to it, because we had crappy doctors, especially when we moved to Houston, that really didn't inform us of this information. So when he found, when we moved to Houston, and then we have core doctors, and speaking of caregiving, your doctors, and the doctors that you choose, and the doctors and how you dialogue with your doctors, that's your first caregiver. Because they're the ones that are describing, giving you your medication and trying to catch your symptoms and foresee what the possibilities, what possibilities lie ahead for you. And we left a really good doctor situation, moved to Houston. We're very scared, had very poor doctors, had never seen an HIV patient before. And then on top of that, very not receptive to either one, doing research so he can help us, and then secondly, when we brought in suggestions, I had to force him to let us take AZT and 3TC. Because he was like, I don't know enough. And it's like, look, here's the literature. I brought it in and said, read it. This is what I want, and I'm not leaving until we can have it. And if you don't do that, if you don't, as your own primary caretaker, take that into consideration, that you don't go in and lay on the table and say, fix me. But instead, you make sure you do the reading, even if you have a really good doctor, and you keep up on things. because of the fact that if you don't, you may be in that situation at some point in time, and you have to twist their arm. So he finally gave us that, but then he said, you know, maybe I'm not the best doctor for you. And so we were then fortunate to find Dr. Shah, who is like the CDC Doctor of the Year for being the infectious disease doctor in the medical center. She was wonderful. She was just great. Well, David started having problems with his throat. And prior to finding Dr. Shah, we had gone to Dr. Hukukud. They're like, oh, no, you know, it's just a tonsil, but it's kind of swollen. Yeah, leave it alone, no big deal, go away. You know, don't bother me, you don't know what you're talking about. So we go home, we leave it alone, we find Dr. Shah. She takes a look at it again, and she says, you know, this is something we need to watch. And we've been sent to an ENT again, who kind of repeated the same thing again. We go to Greece, and we come back from Greece, and we were getting ready to go on another trip. He's like, oh, I keep choking on all my pills.
I couldn't take the medicine. I couldn't stop. Because it comes flying across the river.
Yeah. And he goes, it feels like there's something there. I'm like, whoa, open your mouth. Let me see. You know, we got to go back. And so he opens his mouth, and there's a golf ball on the back of his throat.
Oh, shoot.
You know, and it's like he sticks his tongue out. He didn't really have to stick his tongue out very much. It was just like sitting right in the back of his throat. I'm like, we're not going anywhere. You're going to be a doctor. So we ended up going to Dr. McDonald, a really good ENT who said, you know, we need to do surgery. So next day we go into surgery, and then to find out that they can't cut it out because of the fact that it would have to remove half his tongue, and it would bleed too much. And it already, the little incision that they made, they had a really hard time stopping the bleeding. So, our friends though, and this is our first one at intersection, by this time we found a new church, MCC Maranatha, and we found this church where we were able to, in the small group, the cell groups that we went to, Dave and I spent so much energy in Denver, where we lived, not telling a soul. Our best friends did not know that we were positive. We were just so petrified to let that out. And meanwhile, one of our best friends, his best friend, is dying of AIDS. And
we don't know because he's in the same place.
He's scared to tell us.
Doesn't really know he's told anybody.
And Michael dies, and we find out that he died of AIDS. And all this time, the only time we talked about it was like a week and a half, 2 weeks on the phone. We were in Denver, we found out he was sick, we called him, and we finally both opened up, and he died soon. You know, we didn't even get to see him. He died. And that was horrible, because that just tells you, again, still the stigma, and still a lot of us feel that way. I mean, I'm still not out about being HIV positive at work, and I'm not going to be as long as I can. Even though I know friends that are and they're fine, I still carry that fear of that's my job and that's our lifeline to a lot of things, our benefits and stuff. So that we moved to Houston, and again, it's a very close secret. We're meeting friends, we're making these great relationships, and going to this church. It's wonderful, and we go to it, we're engaged in our small group, and then we find out two of the guys in there start praying about their HIV status out loud. We're just like blown away. Oh my God, they said they're positive. You know, no one's running.
No one's freaking out. Yeah.
No one's like, oh my gosh, you know, and it's like, and so we corner them. After that, we're like, you guys are like open about being positive. And they're like, yeah, these are our friends. This is, everyone knows. I mean, we'd be positive forever, everybody knows. And we were just so blown away by that. But it gave us then the freedom to go, and, you know, the next couple meetings, we're scared to death, we're in prayer, and we're holding each other's hands, and we're like, this is the day. And we told them, and just the love that we got, and then the tears of, like, oh my God. You know, because then, now you see the shift in their head. I might lose you, but I'm glad you told me, but I might lose you. But now at least we realize that we can incorporate them into our family and we can trust. And all of a sudden, a huge burden, and I'm sure stuff that was weighing on us physically was just lifted because, oh, I have to put that energy into
I mean, it's so important, you know, that, and we're starting to realize that too, even though we're positive, but people understand that it's like, if you are positive, you can come out. Well, then what? Nothing's going to change. Relationships are not going to change. We're not going to be like, oh my God. I think one of the fear things too is also that, you know, there are people going to pull away from you and hear that, you know, you're going to die and they're going to lose you and they don't want to have to go through that. And that's a real fear because it's like, you know, especially that long ago, it was a death sentence. You know, everybody was dropping like flies all around us, and it was just like, oh man, our friends don't want another friend that's going to die and have to go through that. And it was kind of selfish not to tell them in so many ways. But it was just horrifying. It was just like, our little secret is just like, we don't have to deal with all the... Because we were so positive together in how we dealt with this. We just didn't need the outside influence. We let our families know, and that was about it. And so, having people that were very deliberate.
Actually, I
had
not let my family know yet.
Oh, that's right, my family. So my family, that's right, my family, we only at that point. But all my cousins, everybody. Of course, I did have one sister, and everybody goes through this probably. It's HIV positive. I haven't heard too many people that have been completely embraced by everybody. But I had a sister that used AIDS. She found out that she was the only person in my entire life that hadn't told her today. And it was because I knew her so well. And I knew it was going to be a horrific problem. And it's all happened to me through my life. I was a single guy, so it was different than it was me. But once he came into my life, all of a sudden, you know, I have a husband. And so told her, and it's like she used the AIDS, and she hated, she told me she could get it back, et cetera, et cetera. Real extreme right wing Christian has been through, you know, same thing that probably a lot of you have been through. And, but she, with my family and everybody else, was so ashamed of her hatred toward AIDS that she decided to use the AIDS as I'm protecting my children. And so it put me in a position where, like, I either call her a liar, you know, et cetera, so I just decided to back off from that for a while. But she's always used the AIDS as, and I'm protecting my children, I don't want, you know, them being around him. I was so close to the kids that her three sons decided that they wanted to divorce me and after me. And so I was like really, really involved with these kids' lives. So we really lose a lot of things because of AIDS. So people will pull back, not just for the pain day, but also because of AIDS. And, so anyways, I hadn't seen her since. And I thought, for sure, coming up on the first one with cancer, I thought, you know, if I ever become opportunistic, ever have cancer, ever have anything that's really horrific, that'll break through, it'll kind of soften the hardness of her heart. You know, she is a Christian, I think she's a Christian, she's not a college as far as manifestation of love, joy, peace, but I think she has a relationship. And so I always assumed that the Lord would really use that kind of a moment to bring her back. And Patrick actually talked to her when I was in the hospital, and the doctor said I actually get her diagnosis, and kind of moving forward a little bit. That, you know, call Gary in because the baby's not going to be dead for a week. And, you know, they get to the night. And it's like, oh my gosh. It's like hearing that kind of stuff. It's just like, this isn't the soap opera. This isn't like somebody else. They're talking about me. And it's... But anyways, he was able to let her know that. He talked to her on the phone. And he's like, don't you want to hear his voice? And she's like, no, I'm not going to talk to him.
Her response was to, if she calls, it would have been edifying his life.
Yeah, you know, deathbed. And so at that point I realized, wow, death isn't going to reach her. And if death can't reach her, then that's my big gun. I have nothing left to try to break through. So even after that was quite a while to kind of let go. But people go to AIDS, and most of you at least know somebody who has it. They go through this. I'm fortunate, that's what I learned in my life. I felt the ground of its position.
Are you supposed to start this one, or is it starting?
It started
yesterday. Like, I just saw it. I was like, oh. And And again, you know, this is talking about, we're talking about caregiving, so prior to going into the hospital for that surgery, it was days of my anniversary, it was our 7th anniversary, and he was scheduled to go into surgery on June 10th, June 9th was our anniversary. And we had planned an anniversary party, you know, because, you know, we've got all these great friends now, they know we're all positive, we're going to bring them all in, and it's going to be great. Well, then he gets this, you know, he's got this lump on his tongue, and got to go in, and so we canceled it. We're just like, no, we're not going to do it. You know, I don't need that stress and washing dishes before he's got to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning to go check in for surgery. So our friends, unknown to us, and actually unknown to me until at the last minute, when they called and they said, oh, come to dinner. You know, come over to, you know, Janine's house for dinner. We're like, no, we don't want to do anything. We want to stay home. So finally, Ernest says, look, drag David over to the house. Because they... Oops, did I ever say backwards?
No,
it's
right.
No, it's right. Yeah. It worked for you. They threw us an anniversary party / wedding.
Oh.
They had rented
the trestle
and decorated, you know, her backyard. There were flowers, there were tables, there were
candles.
You know, and we show up in tank tops. You know, that's our MO. Anybody knows as well as in tank tops. If we wear anything else, no one recognizes us. So we show up, you know, tank tops, and they have little garters for us, and they have this cake, and they throw us an anniversary party. They give us a chance to express, because, I mean, it's kind of scary. I don't know what's going to happen. He goes in, he goes under surgery, you know, maybe he comes out.
Yeah, they don't know.
And we this is our first crossroads. So here again, caregiving. The same friends that we finally were able to include as part of our church family and to rely on as far as our HIV status now are, you know, letting us express our feelings for each other because, you know, just in case.
Yeah, I may not be there the next day. And so it's like we talked about wanting to have an actual public service where we had a ceremony with our friends and a pastor and you have all the formalities, as it were. But we were in habit of heart on that anniversary day, and it just wasn't going to happen. And so they threw us a wedding, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing. We walked into our own wedding, and they had already taken care of everything. Everybody was there waiting for us. And they had already set themselves up as the best man. So, I mean, we walked into a wedding.
And David was so mad at me because I forced him to go.
I was so stressed out because it's like, this was like, oh my God, it's like I could die because I could bleed to death. They're really not, this is a really risky thing. And so I was just like, I didn't want to be around a lot of people. And I just wanted to be with him at home with our dog. And I might be saying goodbye. And I just, you know, I had time to spend my night. And so he, I was being really busy. He got to drag me to this thing. And so when we walked in the door, it was the most amazing gift up to that point that I ever received from friends in my life, because my burden was lifted. It was gone. And I had my wedding, and we were surrounded by people who just loved us so much that they went through this incredible extreme over just the course of a day. I think they threw this together. Everybody did their own part. So.
And I got to begin by saying, no, I'm leaving. Join me, or I will see you tonight. You know, I hate to do that because we don't do that to each other. You know, that's not our way of, you know, treating each other. But it was like, all right, dude, you got to go one way or another. I'm going to get you there. And so that I knew that I'd get it. Like, he's not there. So I'm leaving. You can join me. You can wait. And so then your reaction.
Yeah, then this didn't work. The procedure didn't work. We weren't able to remove the tumor, and it ended up being the size of a snake. It went all the way down the throat, and it was like so thick. When I opened my mouth and pulled my tongue, you could see the end of it. And they found that it was metastasized. So I mean, we were so fortunate for this to happen. It was just, I mean, God's grace. Moving us to Houston, where MD Anderson Medical Center is the best cancer research facility on earth. And I mean, it's so massive too. There's a whole floor. There's like a dozen high rises in this cancer facility. and every floor is your cancer for your treatment in your area. So everybody that I'm surrounded by is going through the same identical thing I'm going through, and I can see the stages of where I'm going to be, which may not be good psychologically, but went through all this radiation because they said the chemo is just not going to do it. The chemo will kill you before it kills the cancer because it's just huge. It's just everywhere we have to just radiate this whole area. And the problem with that is that radiation in the throat is a soft tissue, so it fries the soft tissue. Yeah, it's like putting a piece of wet bread in the microwave. I mean, it just fries this whole area. So after about a month, it was just solid, constant radiation. It has a cumulative effect too. So after your last day of radiation, you think, oh, okay, I'm over. It has 10 days of cumulative effect. So the worst is not over until 10 days after the last radiation dose. And so it got to the point where I couldn't eat, but I couldn't drink water. And then when I got to the point where I breathing just wasn't just excruciating, I'd open my mouth and it looked like red cottage cheese. It was just horrific. And so anyways, that's when they put me in the hospital. For the first time, I'm really in a bad way. And that's when the whole death scenario comes out of the door and I find out, oh my God, I'm going to be waking up tomorrow. And they were absolutely wonderful. Memphis Hospital had a new hospital that they had set up in an apartment complex. The whole apartment complex was nothing but an IMU. And so the doctors, nurses, everything were always right there. It was all internally ill patients. And
we had a two-bedroom apartment.
Oh yeah, okay.
Full kitchen.
It was amazing, and I exited out to a courtyard with a beautiful pond. So it was very unsterile feeling, and it was a place where people that had terminal illnesses that could go and have this intensive care, but not be in a sterile, horrible environment. It's kind of like a study hospital, an experimental hospital. So, anyways, I'm looking at him because they set up a bed for him. There's a bed there for him that he can just move in. So he's been there for a whole month. He's living there in the hospital, and they actually let her dog. I mean, she was always supposed to visit, but when she visited, she stayed, and they just kind of looked the other way. She stayed in bed with all the IVs, and everything was pretty amazing. But I was sitting there staring at myself.
Well, I was just saying, the dog, that's another caregiving thing. It's, you know, for us, our pets, a lot of us that don't have kids, that's our children. And for him, that was his baby. He didn't write a dog for. This was a very special little creature, and it hurt him as much to be sick as it did to be away from his dog, basically. I used to say he'd choose her over me. So, that is true. But she didn't like that. So, you know, bringing, like, very few hospitals, obviously, you can only bring your dog and let the dog live in. And all that, but they had a program on Sundays where they would bring dogs and go to the room, and I thought, oh cool, I can bring Shotzi for the day. So I go and grab Shotzi, bring her in, and then nighttime came around and Shotzi just kind of came in. And Shotzi got the bed with David, and then the nurses came in that night, oh my cute dog, didn't say anything, and so they never gave us permission, we never asked for permission, it just happened.
So for the next month and a half, she's supposed to live with us.
But if that's not possible, you know, you can go drag them in a wheelchair, drag them out to the park, you know, or, you know, wherever you could bring a dog. And so they have contact with this little animal that's so important, because I honestly believe that if Shotzi hadn't been in the picture, he wouldn't be here, or he wouldn't be here as well as he is. She made a huge difference in normalcy, you know, home. I brought home to him. I moved into the kitchen. I brought all my crap, I got my computer, I cooked meals, staff would come over. We had the fun room. And that was another caregiving thing, you know. It wasn't just the staff coming to give us medications and make sure we were taken care of. We had an environment, because our spirits, we always, you know, things are heavy, but we kept it light. Because what can you do? And then they would all come in, and so we always had candy for them, and they'd stop by, this is a fun room. They hang with us.
There'd always be a lot of laughter. And it's important to, I guess it depends on the person, but there's very, very few people I've ever come across that have AIDS that don't love to laugh at their situation. And, you know, good illustration is the word that he went Thursday, or it was Thursday night, right? We were standing there with Jane and Ron. Worthy comes up, aren't you dead yet? Aren't you dead yet? And he's like, I've been wearing black underwear for the last 4 months. When are you going to go? And it's so important to have that kind of humor and to be able, no, that may not come natural for you, but it's okay. And it's okay to break that ice, and it's important to break that ice. You know, and so our room had lots of laughter, and we were so fortunate during this time. We had a whole church full of people. We had times when we had 30 people in this apartment, and people would be praying over the bed. Sometimes we'd be singing. There'd always be lots of joking and laughing. They'd tape my dog's feet with scotch tape, so she's running around the floor like this. And I mean, it was just goofy, fun, normal life, and that was so important. But that night, when I heard that from the doctors, I remember just staring at them because I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to wake up tomorrow. And I could sense it, and I knew death was really close. There was a sense of that. I knew I was really weak. I knew I was really bad. I knew I'd never felt like this in my life. And I was really at peace with it, except for the fact that I didn't want to go. It wouldn't up. It was so funny. There was no fear. But I just didn't want to leave me. I had this wonderful life, and it's like, it just it seemed to start really collating. And so I remember staring at them, just staring and staring, trying so hard to keep my eyes open. Because I wanted to imprint his image and Shakti's image on my mind and on my soul so I could take it with me. And I remember waking up the next morning. And that's when I started transforming, because I think a human being, I started realizing I can't do this. I'm not going to accept this. You know, these words are so penetrating, just like the words of pain that we experience or separation or alienation. Words, hope, oh my God, it's like better than any drug anybody's got. And I started realizing that in my own spirit. And so my whole idea of fighting this battle completely changed. And I realized, I can fight this. I am going to win. I'm not going to accept this. And I am going to live. I am surrounded by hope. I'm surrounded by prayer. I'm inundated, and I'm not going anywhere. I just don't believe in my heart and spirit that my time is done here yet. Of course, I'll be 85 if I reach that point. What the heck is going on? Where am I going? I'm not ready yet, Lord. I'm having fun, so.
Well, then, while we're still at CASA, that's the name of the hospital, and I just want to say something about CASA. When they wanted us to send us there, you know, I'm his advocate, so I'm like talking to the doctors and all that, because he's so sick and under, you know, whatever medication, and so I'm the front person, and they were really good. They allowed me to handle all that. We had all the paperwork done at the hospital for me to be able to do that, but they wanted to send me to CASA, and I said no, because we had heard CASA, you know, people went to CASA to die. People were farmed out to CASA, you know, that you can't be comfortable, and kind of like, you know, that you didn't get out. And so I fought them at first tooth and nail because I didn't know the truth about what CASA was. And so finally, one of the doctors, because our doctor had been gone, it was a different one that was kind of helped trying to get us to go. And finally, our doctor came back, and she was like, look, CASA is meant to, you know, people leave CASA. People go home. And when we went out and she told me about it, we went out there and it was like, oh my God, you know, this is wonderful. So in your own communities and in your own health care plans and or in things that you hear from other people, you know, I didn't have all the information. I thought I did. But I had only information for what I heard, you know, from friends or clubs or whatever. And it turned out to be, had he not gone, you know, he probably wouldn't be here either. So I did fight him on it, and then I found out I didn't have to. But also he had a birthday while we were in there. I was like, oh, great. It's best to have a birthday. So there again, you know, our friends, caregiving, intercession here, they threw him a birthday party. And they, you know, pretty much we did all the work of, you know, getting, we had him, you know, it was a little IV pole, we decorated it, and, you know, had the dog there. She's, you know, still with us. And, you know, he had a really nice birthday party.
It was important that they were so playful. I mean, they decorated, you know, my bedroom. And everything got at the party done, so.
Yeah, it was, and it was, and, you know, and it was funny because I had to kind of like help them walk from, you know, room to room to room, you know, as we went down to this little party room, and then, you know, you walked in, and this was all these people were there, and this is from, again, from people that we knew at that time from Maranatha. And some, a lot of these people are still in our lives, and Pat knows some of them that you may. And then, so we had, you know, a birthday party, which was an incredible thing, because it was something I couldn't do. You know, I'm too busy with just trying to run the house. You know, we still got our apartment, I'm running home, checking bills, all that stuff. I took a month off from work. Fortunately, I had a job that I could do that. But, you know, when you're able, as friends or, you know, partners or whatever, to step in and do the simplest thing, you know, checking the mail. Oh my God, that was just saving a trip across town, you know. Got heavy bills in there, okay, I'll go get them. Little things just make such huge, huge differences. And you feel like you're, oh, this is minor, this is nothing, I shouldn't even offer this. Offer it if you can. And also, too, ask for it. That was really, really hard for me. I don't ask for things very well. I don't mind doing it for you, but I'm very, you know, reticent to ask. I'm not comfortable with that. And, you know, Pat knows that. She offers stuff, and I'm yelling.
People have to force things.
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
Yeah. People have to force things down his throat, and I'm almost as badly sad. I've been through so much of that, it's like I'm trying to realize how to accept, because if I don't accept care and help, if I don't accept care and help, it's like I don't function.
So anyway, we leave Casa, we're healed. I do want to address one thing that, and if this friend, he was very, very, very meaningful and very, he's a wonderful Christian guy, but one thing he did say to me, and I've never gotten angry at this person before, but he sensed my fear. Well, he sensed it, it's like obvious. He and I had heart-to-hearts about, you know, what's going on, what's going to happen. And in trying to caretake for me and to take care of me as well as, you know, make me feel better about David, he tells me that I'm not standing on my faith. He tells me that I need to stand firmly in the promises and know that, you know, he told me to quit worrying. You know, pray to God, sing your praises, stand on the rock, and quit worrying, and get a good night's sleep, because you're going to be fine. You know, and I'm watching him dying and withering away in front of him. The thing he referred to about taping shots at his feet was done because Janine and I, she's one of the ones in the picture, she and I are crying so much, and she's a nurse. She's a nurse practitioner. She and I are crying so much at what he's going through that day that we torment the dog to make us laugh, because it was the only way we could laugh. It was just like, we need some therapy here. So anyway, this guy tells you to stand on your faith, you know, and you know, quit worrying. I got so angry, because it was like, you know, you can go home to your husband. You can go get in your car right now, and you're going home. You're going to go home, and everything's normal. Your dog's there. You know, you're gonna have dinner. I said, I stay here. And so all I can suggest, all I'm saying is, and speaking to is, when we reach out that way to others and in faith and trying to say, you know, be faithful, and God is, you know, God may not have, and I told him, God may not have the same answer that you think I'm gonna get. You know, there may be healing around this, but it's not gonna be David, it's gonna be the people that are touched by his death. And I'm still left with his debt. So don't tell me that. And it hurt so bad. And he, you know, and then we reconciled. It was fine. But I had to just lash out and, you know, shut up, basically. Don't tell me I'm not praying. Because I am, constantly. And so I think, you know, it was, and he never did that again. And I know he didn't mean it that way. But he was just trying to use our common faith bond to nurture me, and instead it was just the wrong combination of words at the wrong time, and instead it just, you know, made my day worse. But ironically, after we had this discourse, then I go back in and I go to talk to David, and one thing David and I have always done is we've always been honest with each other. If I'm watching him die, he's like, how do I love him? He's like, you're dying. I didn't, you know, thought, oh, Bob, anything's fine. He's like, how are you? I'm scared you're dying. I'm scared I can't do anything for you. I can't imagine living without you. We never sugarcoated anything. And, you know, we stressed positive things, but we never lied about the truths. And that night I went back in and I told him what happened between me and this particular individual. And, you know, we cried. And then after we cried, there was just like this incredible quiet in the room. There was this incredible just sense of peace. And I looked at him and I said, do you feel that? He was like, yeah. And I said, you're going home. I knew right then that he was going to get to go home out of hospital. And it was, but it had to come through God's peace, not through, you know, someone telling me. It was God's peace, and it was our honesty with each other and how we were reacting to the situation that brought God back into the situation.
That's something that we just have not really experienced too much, you know, this like direct intervention where it was just like, oh my gosh. Nothing was spoken, no doctor told us anything. It was just like,
weird.
It was just like new. It was the most bizarre thing. It was like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna live. And we both got it, I mean, at the same moment. And no words were spoken about it. It was just bring it alive. It was like, oh my God. It was a pretty amazing thing. We had so many incredible things happen to us. And sometimes I feel like I should be doing more than what I am, because it seems like I'm doing so many miracles that...
So this is the aftermath of, we get out of CASA, things, life picks up again, where, you know, he's no longer, you know, he got it all back. You know, he got his health back. He was just like, oh, wow, we need a fresh start. You know, so this is where we're at. And you want to pick this up?
Yes, we have one of our lunch. And nobody's even spoken on any of this. Like, yeah, if there anything comes to your mind that you want to share, you know, things that you guys have been through, things that are helpful for you. One of the things that we really did want to stress. Yeah.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
And you may or may not be able to eliminate this at all. But from the time period, I have a friend who's been about 20 years with AIDS. Said, well, look, we lost it, you know, back in the 1980s. And you were the, excuse me if I put it this way, you're the only other people I know that were what I would call the initial round of infection that had managed to survive the odds up until today, because we lost so many in there. And I've always been close to Steve. Steve was somebody I met in 1965, you know, and still stay in touch with him. I know what the doctors attributed to his survival. Overall, is there anything that they can point to when others were dropping like flies that you managed miraculously, excuse me if I say that, but miraculously out that this, at a time when others weren't making?
I think that the doctors haven't really told us anything. In fact, we're going to go on and talk about some of the other things that have happened, like some more cancers and stuff, but the doctors have been baffled, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Going through this, our doctors at MD Anderson, now they do, they deal with this cancer in this area, and it's just like, they're just like, I have no idea how on earth you lived. And it's like, I do, it's like I'm surrounded by everything that is every bit as important as medical intervention. And that's my faith. My faith is so important. It's so strong because it doesn't move its center. It's based upon something that's not me, that's not people, ministry, the church. It's based upon God, and God never changes, so it's like I always have this place to run to that never ever changes. It's always there. It's always stable. And then I have all the physical interaction. I have, just, we have an amazing circle of friends that are just always surrounded us and have always loved us and always nurtured us back to health. Patrick has been, you know, I mean, just every little element of my life. But I'd say that the faith and the love and the hope, hope is so important. I mean, every time I work with a AIDS support network that was started in our church, Missouri Methodist Church, and we've got hundreds of guys now involved every week. And You can almost tell he's not going to make it because they've lost their hope. You can see that hopelessness. Does that help? Does that help any of you?
Yeah. See, that's what I'm worried about, this particular friend now. Because he's been on medications for so long. He is alone. I think the togetherness adds so much to your hope.
It does.
He lives in Vegas and I live in Utah, and I'm on the phone and I'm down there as often as I can. But he's beating up, and it worries because he went from an 8,400,000 viral load to undetectable.
Wow, that's awesome.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And the medications are succeeding. He's tired. He's so tired of being, you know, faithful at taking those meds 3 times a day and doing this for nearly 20 years, like you. They don't know exactly when he was infected because he's been a long time. He's been on the regimen. And I just don't know what to do.
I think what you're doing is awesome. I think that,
you know, when people call, spirits up to keep somebody wanting to live because somebody wants them around.
I think love does that.
Is there a way? Does he have a group of friends there that you can help?
He lives a very isolated life. He's so ashamed and embarrassed.
Well, maybe what we can do too, and that's one of the things we're going to do at the end of this, is we can get his name and add him to the list. We're going to set up an email system so that everybody has names that they can email so they can get proactively involved. So they have somebody to email. You can email these people as much as you want, find out their needs. A phone call is amazing. A phone call, Davina called me one of the times that I was in the hospital. Actually tons of people did, but I'm taking one example. Davina called me up, and I mean, we love Davina, we know her, but we're not like real close, and we follow each other's lives a lot. But man, she called up, and it was just when I was just starting to kind of lose a little bit of hope. You know, it was during a really perfect time. I got this thing called concentration tank symptoms, where your body no longer recognizes foods, so it just throws it back out, and it won't digest anything. And she had called right as I was going into this crazy test, and just said, how are you feeling? I'm just thinking about you, I'm driving along the highway, I want to know that I love you. And I mean, it was just the phone call, and I lasted about a minute or two, but it lifted my spirits. And I think it was the element of love. And that's why I said with your friend, that's an amazing gift, because love is what ignites hope. I think love ignites hope. It doesn't mean it doesn't much people understand.
What I was gonna say is, I truly believe this. I think God's not finished with you yet. That's why you're around. And I believe that. Because there's been times that it's like, if you just look at it from medical standpoint, it'd be gone. Yeah. And God's not with you. And that does support hope. When you get over stuff, helps. Not only it shows others that they're going to be in, and there is hope. And I believe God put certain people around that could definitely be the one.
One of our friends from Houston, we have amazing support, and that's definitely what we surround yourself. I surround the person with love constantly, and it doesn't take a lot of time. You know, somebody may stop by once every 2 or 3 days, and it's just like, oh my God, it's amazing. It's just incredible what that does. You just said something and ignited something, and now I've already forgotten it. Go ahead.
I was just saying, we sort of have to fast forward.
Yeah.
and what we have to fast forward is, okay, cancer went taken care of, got out of cause of things, life gets better, cancer cure comes back in his nose. Dog finds it.
In the sinus
cavity, radiation again, boom, get rid of it. Loses his short-term memory. It damages some of his short-term memory. I think it's convenient. But he says, the doctor said, so I have to go with it. So
He had to show it to me nonetheless because he was there with me at the time.
So cancer two, you know, we get rid of that one. Cancer three comes around.
That was the worst
one. That one is where
that is systemic, and that was the worst one. That was really the one worth mentioning because it was 16 cancerous tumors all over my entire body. I had to be in my leg, my groin, my stomach, under my arm, my neck, they were everywhere. And at that point, even the doctors that had experienced these amazing miracles, I had some agnostics, I had some real secular Jewish doctors, I didn't have too many Christian doctors, which is really amazing in Houston, because everybody seems like they're Christian in Houston, but these guys call me their miracle boy, because they're just at a loss for why I'm still alive, physiologically and scientifically. And that has been an amazing ministry. This whole thing has been an amazing ministry. And like Ritter saying that, that's what it is, my dear knight. It's been a ministry for me. All my life, I have sought every avenue that I possibly can to be as an effective person as I can, making as much of a difference. And the biggest thing that I can think of making a difference for is with people's faith and helping them understand their God bless them. And sharing how they know and have a relationship. And I was a youth pastor. I went to Bible College Seminary, youth pastor of several different churches, Youth for Christ Church in San Diego, and nothing ever matched. All these things, all these efforts on my part, all these things that I was doing, did absolutely nothing compared to this survivor. I mean, I was inundated at work. I have a real Bubba job. I'm down on the ramp with at the airport with all these grungy guys, you know, these Bubba men. Very few gay men work down there. Mechanics, baggage throwers, and I'm running around with my little head here, you know, doing ground communication relay, and all these people at the airport all these years have gotten to know me, and they've gotten to know eventually that I'm gay. Eventually a lot of them got to know that I'm positive also. And the fact that God healed a gay man in a 16-year relationship with AIDS that has cancer just blew me away. And I have these big brothers. I mean, for every single day at work, and I'm literally, I wrote it in my calendar because it started getting so overwhelming. Every single day for over 8 months, I was inundated with people, most of you crying, just saying how it changed their life, how it's watching this has just changed their idea about gay people and God and who God is. And she's like, it's hard to struggle to stay alive. I mean, it's like, how are you getting all of this out of this? Because all I'm doing is just by the skin of my teeth, just trying to hang on to life. And this is my ministry. This is the biggest ministry I've ever had in my life, and it has nothing to do with me because I'm just trying to hang on. So they're seeing something, God, at work in a way that it's amazing. It changed everything. I work with this AIDS ministry also that I'm talking about. That we've got hundreds of guys now coming in. Most of them had such a tremendous lack of hope. And seeing one of the leaders, you know, that's teaching them and counseling them, you know, go through this and a direct absolute healing, because everybody knows what it means when you have all that, when you have AIDS. It changed the whole ministry. It's like all of a sudden they started believing God does help them. You know, he deliberately intervened and healed the gay man or the AIDS and cancer, and it's like, it was obvious. It was so cool that it was so obvious. Anyways, it's been the most awesome ministry I've ever had in my whole life. And it's not a ministry, really. And that's why it's like, wow, what is your ministry? Like, I found out by waking up and all these people are coming to me crying, and this big Bubba, you know, redneck Bubba's coming up to me, hugging me, crying on me, you know, on the back where nobody can see us. And it's saying, can you pray with me? My wife is going to leave me. And another one, my kids are really having a hard time with me. I can't deal with them. My kids are drugs. It was just like, oh my God, they're coming to a gay man with AIDS for spiritual nurture. Yeah, I know.
And apologize for all the fast forwarding, but there's been so many ups and downs, as many of you know, in our relationship and in this health battle. That, you know, we went through, got rid of that cancer, got rid of, there was another one after that, another cancer lesion on the skin.
In the arm.
On his arm, we rid of that.
That was an easy one. That was a serious one.
Okay, that was so nice. But you know, again, we're leaning heavily. Meanwhile, you know, we now have, you know, an EC group, and we have friends, Pat, Ray, and part of that group, and then we have a larger EC community. And again, you know, we go through more battles. We go through, you know, now after EC in 2003, he ends up with CMV, Mac. He's got diarrhea. Just, I mean, he's lost. We go from where we were, the pictures that you've seen, to, you know, we go to, you know, this, you know, these two pictures of David. You know, here we are on the beach in Hawaii, you know, the top picture. And, you know, he was emaciated. He was just down to nothing. And
we still try to travel and try to keep life as normal as possible and have a big moment when I'm on a plane and go somewhere. And I guess I should probably tell this part too, because it's really important. But I got CMV in my stomach. Usually it's all in your mucous membrane, but for me it's all in my stomach. And I guess you can go all the way down the digestive tract. And it's a virus that's really actually worse than cancer. I've never felt it any worse than cancer. And it settled my digestive tract and shut my whole system down. And then the other thing it did is it caused the muscles and everything else just to completely disintegrate almost. And you can't control your bowel. And so for 2 years, I had uncontrollable diarrhea. And I mean, literally. And there were times when I just didn't make it. And there's nothing more demoralizing and humiliating. In fact, while I was going through it, I tried so hard to just, I mean, very few people unbelievably knew that going on in all the places, you know, panic and incredible fear, and you're all of the basic humanity that you can possibly mess up this time, because you're completely, and then I looked like that. My face was gone, and actually that's a really good picture of those two, because that's when I'm not in the hospital, I'm not at my worst, that's actually when we're out to dinner and
Yeah,
and
we don't have pictures of
him
in the hospital.
But a lot of really demoralizing things happen when you lose your body, and that's one of them. I mean, it was just terrific. I mean, I still deliberately went to parties and church and movies, but sometimes even in a theater situation or going to a restaurant with my parents, it would be like, all hell would break loose, and I'd have to go home.
Well, and again, too, from a caregiving standpoint, it's like you're being sensitive to. You know, her friends would invite us to dinner, and our dinner parties were like, okay, how many people are going to be there? How many bathrooms are in this house?
That's the first thing we always do, is look for where the bathroom is. You know?
Yeah, or if it was somebody's house we knew, it was like, oh, God, there's only one bathroom, there's only 10 people there. And, you know, number one, you don't want to be caught waiting for the bathroom when all those breaking loose. And then secondly, it's embarrassing to be constantly running to the bathroom, even though they're your friends. And all our friends, I mean, Pat has been so gracious to us, Ray. You know, Pat was like, you know, every time David's in the hospital, I'm calling blubbering. You know, I'm on the phone, and it didn't matter what, you know, Pat would be there. Pat would come in, Sanjay would come in. I mean, it was incredible. People bring us, you know, food, just, you know, bringing either food to the house, you know, we'll eat with you, we'll cook you dinner and eat with you at your house and then do the dishes and take the dishes home because they were theirs. Or they would, you know, bring us, you know, camp out to give me a break at the hospital because I was living there. So they come in and just stay, you know, bring a book, come talk to David, watch TV, whatever, and give let me get out of the house. But I also have to bring up, email.
And when you look like this,
you're upside down.
You're not upside down again?
You're up in the ceiling.
Or I'm dyslexic, I'm just okay. When you look like that, and you got to the point where I was even actually worse than that. We don't really have any communication. But I actually look kind of good there, but that's even bad enough that it just got to the point where I couldn't even look in the mirror anymore. It was just so disturbing because I didn't even recognize the person. And it was just so, it wasn't vanity anymore, it was just absolute horror. You know, you don't recognize the face that's coming back at you, and so I just had to stop looking in the mirror. And I did. I mean, I had the months at a time where I didn't see my reflection. I would just feel my hair, and, you know, of course, you know, when you look like that, it's like everywhere you go, people stare. And, you know, I started realizing how bad I looked when I went to the supermarket. I felt so good one day. I went out and went shopping. I actually went by myself. I drove, and I was like so proud of myself. I got to the checkout stand, and people are kind of looking at me back, starting to get used to that. And this lady's just like, she was the sweetest thing. She little black lady. Honey, are you okay? Do we need to help you out to the car? Do you need to go to the hospital? I mean, it was like, oh my God. I really do look that bad. I haven't seen myself in a long time. It's like, what do I look like? But you lose that part of humanity too. You lose the ability to feel like you're not a freak show. And it's horrifying because of the fact that I never let it keep me from going out. I decided I wanted to do plays and movies and just like the diarrhea, just like that. And I was starting to live, especially since, you know, this time around it was maybe I wasn't going to live. And this time around too, we were floating on that line of life and death, constantly teetering on that for 2 years, because for 2 years the doctors had nothing to help me with. I was in this place and there was nothing. I was resistant to every single drug. I didn't have one drug that I was completely resistant to. And because of that, they couldn't help me. So every single time I'd get a side virus or disease or problem, they would just start piling up and they couldn't get rid of it. They would just try to manage the symptoms, but they... So it was amazing. It was your prayers. It was the prayers of all the church and people that I've been praying for. It's not a love. It's got no life for there. And then this new drug came on the market, boom, it blew it out, and it's just been a massive miracle.
I'd like to address email. One thing you always hear about email is, oh, it's someone personal. Oh, it's, you know, don't email people, call them, you know. But with our schedule, the way things were, you know, the people I could talk to were the ones that were local. But then, you know, I had a lot of, my schedule revolved around trying to keep my job, keep the house going and stuff like that, doing things that I hated, absolutely, he did, like mowing the yard and living twice while he was sick. That was it. But, you know, so at night, finally, I had a chance, it's my time. He's in bed, I carried him from here to there. And caretaking, as the primary caretaker, is exhausting. It's exhausting and it's wonderful at the same time, because you know you are there, and I wanted to be there in every possible way. And yet, it was, I can't tell you how many times I helped him settle into whatever, and then I go to the other room and cry. Or, many times during this journey, you know, he was so tenuous that, you know, I called a friend of mine in Denver, was talking with him, and he's like, I will fly down and stay with you and be there when he dies, so we can all know when he dies. And I knew friends in Houston would be there with me also. All I had to do was ask. And so then you can't do anything. You go from room to room to room because you just are so distraught. You sit down, I love to surf on the net. You know, I sit down and surf on the net, I can't do this. So I go in the kitchen, I tear the kitchen apart, I'm gonna clean all these cabinets and I got crap all over the floor, and then I can't do that. All of a sudden that just chases me out of that room. I go in another room and then there's memories of all our trips in that room. I can't look at that, I need to go. And so I found myself just, you know, running. And so I would sit down and write emails. And this is just one example of an email I wrote. And I would send it out to, many of you got these emails, and I would get responses from Jamie Allen, Gothen, Pat, Gothen, you know, our Houston friends, but it went all over. And then what was even more amazing was these would be sent to other ministers and other churches who would write us, and I had no clue who they were, but we were on their prayer chains, and so we were just on prayer chains everywhere. And I wrote, I had no idea what to say. Perhaps we left the hospital too soon. Perhaps this is just the way the road is taking us and there are no alternative routes. I wish there were. David has declined since we left the hospital. He is once again unable to eat, not vomiting at least, but has such stomach upset and pain on the side he has had today. All he's had today is a scrambled egg and a few tablespoons of applesauce. His diarrhea continues. What is he releasing? And he is so weak, he cannot hold himself up at times. We may be going back to the hospital soon. Please include us in your prayers for strength and nourishment for David and strength for me. The road is taking its toll, and I need and want to be there for him. Thanks. I wish I had better news to report. My weevil, I call it my weevil. They wobbled the bill. Hold on. My weevil is wobbling again. Perhaps this is just the way it will be. I really don't know. And I would get responses, you know, from, and all hours of the night. And,
I'm just going to raise my response. Patrick, I pray each time I receive a note from you, I am awed by what you have allowed everyone to see through your eyes and through your heart. Given our positive status, I have often pondered what we are being prepared for. The word says to be strong and take courage, banish fear and doubt, for the promise of God is to bless your coming in and bless your going out. What I know of God's promises is that they are true. I know how incapable I am of offering you anything that can bring peace to your mind. God can. Storms are quieted with God's hand. I will pray for the quiet to descend on you as you need it. If there is something that can be done humanly, please know that we are here and willing and available to do that for you. You and David are rare people indeed, and God has plopped you down in the midst of our lives to show us grace in a time of trial. Again, I am in awe. You have only his respect and love. That's what I would get. And I can't tell you what that meant, you know, to get that. And that's one of, I kept them all. I'm probably going to compile a journal of that or something. But email is not in person. Email, phone calls, emails, messages, just a message on the answering machine, message on the cell phone when it's turned off so they get it when they turn the phone on. You know, again, just the dumbest little thing that you can possibly do for somebody, leave a balloon on the side of the door. Nothing is, and all of that contributed to us being here.
We're held by the love of everybody that's been around us, not just by each other.
And the prayer.
The prayer. I mean, the one thing is, above anything else that we definitely want to get through on this workshop is the proactiveness that everybody had in our life made quite a huge, massive difference it made in our life. You know, he started with emails, and I mean, he's constantly on the email. He's on there every single night, probably. I mean, there were months when, you know, every single day was hell. But in the middle of all that hell, we had all this incredible love. And to be able to go to that place where you're supposed to die, and everybody's flying in to say goodbye, and the people coming in from everywhere, and people calling, and to get to that point and have all that love, because people say things, I say things when I'm in that place. Things happen and are interactive. And to be able to come back with all those things intact has been the most amazing blessing that I've ever received in my life. I know how much I'm loved. You know, we've been back to this place three or four times now where the doctors say they're dead, you know, they're dying, it's not going to be good at the end of the week, come say goodbye. People fly in, people coming in, people call. And so now I'm just telling everybody, it's like, okay, you've had enough expense. The next time we cry wolf, you don't have to come.
Well, we didn't cry wolf, they just came.
Yeah, they just came. So there's just so much ministry that he has to come. And there's so much ministry that he needs to come. And we want to make understood how vastly important these little teeny pieces that people think are so insignificant mean, because when we get something like that, he gets that meal in there, he's awake all night because I can't sleep. He's looking at me and, you know, that picture is good. I mean, sometimes you can see every single bone in my face and every single little piece of vein. And, you know, it's unbearable to look at that. I mean, I'd be in so much pain all the time, even on IV morphine, that, you know, there was 5 or 6 months almost nonstop where it was like, you're like, crying every night in your sleep. You're like groaning and in pain. You know, how do you hear that? You know, how do you hear that from your partner and see that? And it's every day, it's every night. You never escape it. And this then comes in the middle of the night and pulls it up and it's like, oh my God, somebody's there, somebody cares. You know, somebody validated my worth and what I'm going through by giving me a little note and letting me know that they're there. You know, somebody picked up the phone and called me. I mean, it was just a short phone call, but oh my God. You know, the people that came and visited, I mean, people that were in town, and they just inundated our rooms constantly full. People are constantly in and out. It makes all the difference in the world, because when you're in that much pain and that much grief, and, you know, you're scared because you're sitting on that edge of death. Even when there's peace, there's still that edginess. There's that, like, I don't want to leave. And to get people coming and visiting is amazing. I mean, people sell flowers and, you know, balloon on the door, you know, people set up birthday parties for me. I've had so many birthday parties with IV poles, and, you know, it's just been wonderful. A lot of times you can't do those things, and everybody does it for us. And so the nurturing that we've gotten has made the whole world a difference. If we didn't have that, I don't even know how we would have managed without everybody, because the fact that every time we started falling into despair, the Lord always provided somebody to pull us out. And a lot of times it was just a phone call, an email, something that's only lasting a minute. No investment, hardly at all, they thought that it meant the whole world to us.
And it also, you know, between the relationship that existed between us was such that, you know, you look at me and I'm the caretaker because I'm the one that's healthy and doing all this. But honestly, in this kind of relationship, he was caretaker as well because of the fact that I could go to him and I could say and be honest. And I could, one time I'm carrying him from, bed to bathroom. And I'm carrying him from bed to bathroom and he says, oh my God, this is no way to live. And it's the first time I've heard him say this. And so I'm like, does this mean, I said, what do you want to do? Do you want to keep fighting? Are you ready to quit? I said, I will do what you want to do. If you want to fight, I'm here and ready, let's go. But if you're tired, and this, I have to address to your question, it's like, you can do everything humanly possible on the outside to and spiritually possible to motivate and keep somebody going. But at some point, it's their decision. And I clearly asked him, it's like, are you tired of this? Do you want to stop? If you want to stop, tell me. It's okay. I don't want to lose you, but I also am not out to, force you to live. And so if we hadn't had that kind of talk, if I couldn't have been honest with him, and he wanted that. Had I not been honest with him, that would have made his journey that much harder too. But we were always... And hopefully, I can't say that applies to every situation, but I would say that that's waters that should be tested with whoever it is if you were in that situation of helping somebody, is be honest and be upfront and don't sugarcoat stuff. Because they know, I couldn't have said, oh, you look wonderful. Yeah, right. Oh, you're fine. You're gonna be just fine. How does that help? That doesn't help. But instead, if I'm honest and we're honest with each other, and he consequently gets to nurture me and take care of me, and that gives me strength to continue to take care of him.
And I grew up in one time when it was actually when the first when CMP first started this last round of things, and a lot of you saw that, but then the last 2 years because I just look so bad. Before that all started, I started with decline. We went to Paris, and anybody who's been to Paris knows there's not a lot of bathrooms. The CMP kicked in when we were in Paris, right after my birthday, and I was constantly running to bathrooms in Notre Dame, pretending like I was looking at a menu at a cafe, and I went down, like, oh, maybe I need to wash my hands, but that's good. I mean, it was just like insane. That's when it started. It came back home, just got worse and worse, and finally, it got so bad that I was literally going like 20, 30 times a day. And it was just so painful. And he left on a trip. He left on a Monday afternoon, got back Wednesday morning. And when he left, I was 20 pounds heavier when he got back. And so the person that he left at home was not the person that he came in. And he just broke down crying. I know I look like that.
Do you remember the Bounty commercials? The lady that has when she smiles, she has the teeth that kind of...
Jay. Yeah. Oh, Jay upside down.
Yeah, trying to think of her name. She... He...
So much flesh show, I guess.
Yeah. Scandalous. Yeah. I don't think you'll get too excited about her name there. Jay's oh, one thing I did want to do. We have an amazing.
No.
That's 15 minutes left.
Is it
4:30
to what?
5:00.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking 4:30. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay. We have an amazing. One of our best resources is Pat's email bank that was just kept up in the building. And so we got a massive email bank that we just, you know, just one button sends out the same message to hundreds of people. And we get the response, we get inundated with that bank. And so it made us realize that a lot of people don't have that kind of resource. And other people who do have the resource maybe don't have as much. And you can always do more. There's no such thing as too many emails, too many phone calls. You know, there's no such thing, especially when you're going through hell. And so what we wanted to do and start, and hopefully we'll start building from here, and become something a lot bigger. We want to do something significant over the day as far as at least starting something simple. And if you're willing to put your name on the email list, what we'll do is compile the email list and we'll send out the email, all the emails to everybody. So that way you've already got the beginnings of a bank. And when somebody is hurting or somebody's in need, that person has a whole bank that they can just hit one button, boom, they can email a whole bunch of things. And then you automatically have an opportunity to help people as well. And a lot of you guys are the ones that are helping us anyway, but we just thought we'd try to start an email bank, and from there maybe start working and maybe make something bigger out of this eventually over the years and turn it into something where we can hook people up with other people that are in the same city. You know, say you're willing to give somebody a ride, people that can't drive. Are you willing to come over and clean their house if they're bedridden? Are you willing to make up dinner? I mean, one of the most amazing things that some of our friends did, not only did they make us dinner, but they came over and ate it again. And so they kept us company. It seemed like we were never alone.
We were never allowed to, do any of these processes. You know, any of these, it's like we've been the sine wave. It's just up and down constantly. I'll be honest for myself, and I think David probably feels the same way, as like he's doing wonderfully now, and we're enjoying the heck out of it, and we're traveling, and we're doing things because you can't take it for granted. I mean, and I've been doing well all these years, and who knows? Maybe it's my turn. You never know. And there's another thing about HIV is that what I'm watching him go through, I'm also at the same time going, is that me? But not only is that me, but is that me without him? Because he's going to go, and that's also his worry.
Yeah, leaving him behind. He's not ready to take care of him.
He's thinking, this is going to be Patrick, and I'm not going to be there for him. Who's going to be there for you to take care of you when you can't walk to walk? And it's a very, it's surreal kind of. And then it's also for our friends that are HIV positive. Said the one I read. I feel like we're. I wonder if we're watching what's in store for us. Is there a bug positive? And how do you, you don't know. You never know. So, it's just that, and I don't know how many times I put his memorial list together, because I started compiling the list. Who am I going to call? Who will want to know about him passing away?
And that's another nice thing that we have with a friend there, give us all the phone numbers of everybody, because he's not going to be in a place to call people when they're dead. You know, like all of a sudden he's like left with his empty house and all his grieving. And we have this amazing marriage. I have been so blessed. I mean, I don't know that. I don't know of anybody else who has a marriage like this personally. I mean, I just never imagined having this kind of thing. I mean, Jane Lux, when you have an incredible marriage and somebody living out like that, and you lose it, the loss would just be outrageous. But I was more concerned about him, that I was going to die at that point. It's like, okay, I'm teetering on the edge, I'm going, but this is ridiculous. So, one of the most important things I think that I want to start pursuing over the next couple of years is building up not just this bank and care teams that can help people in your own city, but making sure especially that the people who are single that are going through this really, really are looked after and looked out for, because the guys in my group that come to Houston that are single, and especially the ones that are more shy and won't reach out for help.
Or don't want to.
Or don't want to, yeah, because those are the people that we really need to watch and look out for. So we can kind of build a whole ministry inside of the ministry.
Well, that brings up the question that I've been meaning to ask both of you. When I was sick a couple times this last year, there seems to be a part, the beginning part, where you don't want to tell anybody because you don't know
how bad it's going to be.
How bad it's going to get, or if it's going to get bad, or if, whether it's worth worrying people over. At what point do you say, you open up the door and just say, okay, I need help? Because for us, it's sort of off. We tend to be sort of public in our EC lives, but when it comes to this kind of thing, we tend to turn it in and be very private. And how do you sort of step out of that and say, it's okay, I need help, because you don't tend to be that way?
Can I ask you though, is it because you're being private, or is it because you don't want to bother somebody?
I think it's a combination of both. I think it's, when it really comes down to it, it's that we don't want to bother people with our issue.
Right, and I would address that.
Yeah, so, I would say, I'm all in the middle.
Yeah, immediately.
If you know that you're getting sick, or if you're going to have to go to the hospital, or you're going to have surgery, call
them. We do that
anyway. People need time to arrange your schedule so they can use your health. Yeah, and the sooner you can call, the better it is.
Which is helpful, because if it doesn't turn out to be something serious, then it's not a big deal.
But there's a celebration.
Right.
So you have a plan.
That's really helpful to know.
So anymore we start out immediately, we solve.
Right.
Do we tell people as soon as it happens, as soon as something's on the horizon, it's like heads up, something might be coming, and it may be nothing, pray to God it isn't, but it might be, give you a heads up, that way people know, people can start praying, people can start interceding before it actually becomes something.
Right.
And I mean, the other thing that I really wanted to, I'm glad you brought that up, that didn't even click, I didn't look at my phone, looked at my notes all the time, but one of the most important issues, especially for those of us who are positive, you know, as far as reaching out, the one thing that I've learned through this, going through all this crap, and learning how to accept people, because that's so hard. It's easier to give than receive. It's so hard to be a good receiver, because I'm saying I need you, and I can't take care of myself, and I've never, we have never ever needed help financially or anything ever in my marriage. But it's like, when somebody reaches out to me and says, I need you, I'm hurting, I'm feeling sick, I'm scared, I'm emotionally unstable right now, I just feel disjointed. Oh my God, what that does to me. I mean, I can't hear that, and I can hear that 50 times a day and never stop crying over it, because what that's happening is that somebody's telling me that I have enough worth and value, that they want me to be part of their life and solution, even if I can't even do anything. The fact that they're just telling me that they want me in that element of their life, it's just, it's absolutely overwhelming. You know, it's like, oh my God, I need it. And thank God people have allowed me to be in that place, even when I looked like that. People have still reached out and said, oh my God, I'm sorry to bring my burdens on you. And it's like, oh, no, that's what I lived for. And I mean, I think that most people, especially the people that are here, are people that are like that. They want to be needed. I mean, I need to be needed. I don't just want it, I need it. I live for it. And so when somebody calls me up, even if they think it's the most insignificant thing, what they have just done is they have told me that I am that important to them. I have value, I have worth, I am loved, I need it. And so I'm providing a whole other sense of need and fulfilling a whole other part of a person's life by making sure that they understand they want it. So, you know, hopefully that'll blow that out of the water a little bit. It does for me by saying, oh my God, it's like I'm going to start plugging them again. We've gone through this like 100 times this month already. It's like, oh, people are supposed to be hearing this stuff. No, they're not. It's like they're blown away to keep on reaching out. So, start it immediately.
You guys do that.
You get cold.
It'd be hard if funny guys email everybody. And, oh my God, you know, something happened. And that's how I was, because it was like, who knows what that was going to lead to? You don't know
right. What
it will lead to.
It's supposed to be me. There's a, I was doing their wedding.
It didn't print properly. David is off to the side in this picture. And it was another picture of him when he was actually performing their wedding. And
they had to put a stool, they wanted to get married in our gardens, in our backyard. And they wanted a real simple private wedding, and they wanted to perform it. And so, but I was so sick, I wasn't mobile really. And so we set up a stool where I could sit out in the backyard and perform their marriage. So, but But I looked horrible in that picture. In
fact,
he's taking this David. He's on the credit on the paper now.
Oh, so, and you guys want to contribute anything or anything, say anything?
Oh, yeah.
So you guys have been through.
I was just going to follow it, Jane, and ask yourself, how long do you want them to wait to ask for your help?
Yeah, it's real good.
And Ron's always famous for saying, don't judge my mood, don't judge my relationship with help. Don't judge our relationship with me and me help. Allow us the opportunity to see you. This is you and so that.
It's hard when, you know, people like yourself, you guys are so giving. I mean, you truly are. You're amazing people. I mean, that's probably why we're so drawn to you. Our friendship is so close. But people like you guys have a very difficult time probably reaching out and asking you for help because you're so used to being the ones to help. And that's a wall that the Lord has broken down in our hearts because of the fact that we have so much crap. It's just like, we can't take this.
We can't, knowing you can't take it, you can't do it all. I mean, the person going through it, or, you know, if someone's alone, or like you guys, you know, you work on the other side of town, and, you know, Jason at home. So,
I think that's the hardest part of it. Not just the fear of being weak and vulnerable, but it's the I can't do it.
Yes.
I'm not able to, because I can do it for other people and I can't do it for myself, and that's really hard. I mean, and that's just, it's really just a fear thing. Sure. I just have to get.
It's a social thing. It's how we're socialized. We're supposed to, you know, someone offers you food, you know, and you go, oh, no, I couldn't. You really want it.
Right.
You know, and you really want to eat the whole thing, but you think, oh, no, the plain answer is no. I mean, we're taught that all our lives growing up, no matter where you live, that you always graciously decline. You know, I couldn't possibly. You know, damn it. So, you know, I mean, really, but this is not that situation.
Right.
And again, it's like, you know, all the times you've helped people, how much has it brought you closer? How much has it brought us closer? You know, I mean, really, when I call Pat on the, you know, and come home from work, I find out while I'm working and I'm coming back from Guatemala, wherever I was that particular day, you know, I call the phone and I get all these messages, David's in the hospital, you know, and it's like, okay, you know, that's a nice way to come home. And, you know, so then, and then, you know, the things that happen, I call Pat on the phone, I'm blubbering on the phone, oh, my God, you know, and the mom and Pat came out, and, you know, she just held me, nurtured me over the phone and talked to me and let me cry on her shoulder, and, you know, my brother, I call him blubbering, you know, and he drives up that day, and drives home from San Antonio the same day, but just comes up just to see, he's like, you sound adorable, I mean, we come see you, and came to see David.
It's amazing what people do when you give them the opportunity. I mean, yeah. You know, because it's like when, if I understand what is happening when somebody's reaching out to me and I really see it, oh my gosh, there's nothing I wouldn't do that I can do, I will do. Because I want to. And I don't think that's unusual. I think that's incredibly common, especially in our house. And so it's incredible. We don't ask for anything specific. We just say, and all of a sudden somebody comes over with chicken soup, or somebody comes over with a meatloaf and sits down and has dinner with us, and all of a sudden somebody, I mean, I'm constantly begging people to come over and, you know, take him to the museum, take him to lunch, get him out of the hospital room. It's like, I'm stuck here, but he doesn't have to be in it. Like the guilt of leaving the hospital room, it's so weird. I understand it because his parents kicked me out of the hospital room a couple times because I just hadn't slept for days. You know, I looked like I was going to be in the hospital soon. So they were kicking me out of the hospital. And I mean, the whole time I'm just crying, driving home crying around the house doing stuff, crying as they're coming back. And as soon as I'm with him, it's like, I'm in peace again. And I'm with him. But he needed to get out of the hospital for a ride. And so that was a ministry of people coming over, taking care of him. And then also people that nurtured him while I was in such a horrible state. And that was important because he's watching the love of his body. He's watching a lot of his life dying and just absolute pain. And, you know, he may have been through a whole night of crying and moaning and screaming. And I don't even know that I did that. I wake up and it's like, I bounce around and I've had a whole night of crying and screaming, and he's had to hear it. And,
And those of you that have been in the situation, you know, like we're all, you know, perhaps, you know, you're, all you can do is watch. You know, you're powerless. You know, you got the medications, you got the doctors. Nighttime is hateful. Weekends are hateful because, you know, doctors' offices are closed and, you know, nighttime, it's like you're talking to the emergency nurse who has to call you back, and you know, you've got to wake somebody up at 3 in the morning because, you know, their temperature is 105 and should we go to the hospital? You know, and that was common. I mean, it was common for him to run 103, 104. You know, it got to the point where I was like, well, it's only 104. You're right. You know, and that's a, you know, it was a horrible thing to get used to, but, you know, even the moaning, I would hear him moaning in the other room, and I was just like, well, it's not a different kind of moan, it's the same one as always. And it comes to find out that moaning releases endorphins, which decreases your pain. So, you know, ask your friends that are nurses. You know, hey, you know, I complained, I didn't complain, but I was like, God, I told Janine, oh, it just kills me, I hear him moaning. And she's like, well, actually, that's a good thing. And she told me why. And I was like, oh, great, moan more. It's okay then. You know, and it made me feel better. But I wouldn't have done that had I not gone to my group of people that are helping me and asked that question and made that statement. So.
And those of you that are in the medical field, it's really, that's such a blessing. Yeah, you have a couple of cousins that are doctors, we have a couple of friends that are physicians or nurses. That's an amazing thing to have people like that in your life.
Just know that they're calling. Well, you guys have got the abbreviated version of 16 years of ups and downs.
Is there anything else?
Any questions or comments or whatever? Or?
Anybody have any insights too? Right? Yeah. Everybody's probably been through stuff. So maybe you have something that really just thought of as amazing to me.
Tell us what your current health status is.
Yeah, it's amazing. I went from lows that were just death to my viral loads are now undetectable to zero. My CD4s were, I think, still in the double digits, and now we're 800. My CD4s have never in my entire 16, 17 years of taking them, they have never been over 250, which is full-blown AIDS, so I've never been out of full-blown AIDS until last month. So this medicine is just an amazing thing, so I'm almost back to normal. My biggest complaints are, I'm like an 80-year-old, I have horrible rheumatoid arthritis and advanced neurological problems. Sometimes I can't walk, but oh my God, I have a life again. And those are the worst things I have.
Well, what are you on?
Actually, you know something? Morphine. I thought of that because I do speaking engagements a lot with HIV groups and people to help them inform them about HIV. And one really very effective thing is to bring all the medicines and throw them out on the table. And I should have done that. I have them here. I do three different shots a day. I have to inject myself. Unfortunately, it's subcutical, so I have to find fat, and so I have to be sticking my stomach and everything, because I don't have a lot of fat. This is a bump from this morning's shots here. I just sit there like a lump. And so for me, not having fat has been a real, real problem, because I need the fat for the shots. I'm also taking a study drug, TMC-125, doesn't even have a name yet, and that is what is blowing it up. Because I was completely resistant to everything else. I'm also taking Intriva, Variad, Videx, Centroid, Morphine, Sulfatron, I know that, like,
you're taking arthritic drugs,
gabapentin for
remnants, results of the medication.
So it's about 14. But I'm down to 14 drugs, and it's about 30 pills a day. No, it's about 36 pills a day.
And when you're in my position, or when you're in a position of caretaking for somebody or something, one of the most frustrating and heart-wrenching things is to see somebody work so hard. I know I sent an email about that at one time. You know, watching him work out at the gym, and you know, he was like, he looked, you know, on the whole beach in Hawaii, and he's got his tank top on, he's at the gym, and he's lifting, you know, 5 pound weights and doing curls. When he used to work, you know, he used to outlift me. You know, and now he's struggling with these, you know, little weights. But he's trying, and he's faithful. He's there. He's He doesn't miss his medications. He's like, oh God, it's midnight, I gotta do all this stuff. He does them. He's not the drug holiday kind of person ever. And you see all that, and you see him dying anyway. And again, that's when I'm reaching out, because it was so incredibly painful to see that. It's like, God, no one can try any harder. And you know, I'm screaming at God, leave him alone. It's not God's fault. So, you know, it's been a ride, but I would...
When you have all these side effects left over from everything, each time that I go through stuff, I take a couple things with me. You know, like the scar tissue in my throat from the radiation, that'll never go away, so I'll never be able to, you know, swallow a big pill ever again in my life. I have to chew them. And so, a lot of times I don't even tell the doctors, because they're like, you're not supposed to chew, but it's like, well, I need this one, this script, just not tell you. But, so that's why when you see me taking pills, I think, I'm swallowing my pills, because if I swallow them, I'd gag, and I'd be bad, so. Anyway, anything else for anybody before we close?
Thank you. I just want to close by saying this, for me and for him, and I know he feels the same way, this is not a ride you would sign up for. This is not a ride that you would volunteer for and say, ooh, let's do this, this is fun. But 16 years of it, I do it all again because of who he is and he's standing here with me. And, you know, I want to have an 80th birthday and have a 50th wedding anniversary. And so, you know, as hard as all this sounds, when you have the right combination of the person you care for and your friends, the doctor, the nursing community, everything all around you, in a weird sort of way, it's all, not in a weird sort of way, it's worth it. And I do it all again.
There's been a lot of joy in all this.
Yeah, there has been.
All I haven't emphasized on that, but oh my God, the joy that you have when you're in such a horrible place is so deep. And the love that you're experiencing is so penetrating. I'm really thankful that I've been able to go through this. Because the fact that, you know, the other thing that I have more than I ever thought I ever would have had this entire time. So, it's been an amazing experience. I don't want to just leave you with, oh my God, this poor guy. No, we have everything that I ever needed. It's just some pain. So, but anyways, does anyone want to close this together? We usually hold hands on Texas, but my God, the hand makes it something here. Thank you. Thank you guys so much for giving me the chance to bring this love to me. It's the opportunity, not just to love, but to love me as well. It's crazy that it helped us. Thank you guys.